This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to The Documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Stephen Sacker, host of the BBC's Hard Talk podcast, with in-depth, hard-hitting interviews with newsmakers from around the world. Welcome to Hard Talk from the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. Today's is a special programme, remembering some of the past Hard Talk guests who died in 2024. All of them made a significant impact on the world around them, whether it be in politics, civil society activism, or in culture. Let's start with Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption campaigner and Russia's most prominent opposition leader, who was targeted for assassination several times. He miraculously survived poisoning with deadly Novichok nerve agent in 2020. Having recuperated in Germany, he returned to Russia, where he was swiftly convicted and imprisoned in the harshest of conditions. His death was announced on February the 16th this year. Back in 2017, I spoke to him in his Moscow office as he made plans to run against Vladimir Putin.
I'm not a naive person. I understand that Kremlin is very unhappy with me running, and I understand that they will do everything to prevent me from running. And recently, several Kremlin officials said that he's not allowed to participate, but still I'm going to appeal to the people and ask for them support. And I do believe that people's support can prevail the strategy, what kind of strategy Putin has against me.
Boris Nemtsov, whom you knew very well, was walking down a street just a couple of hundred meters from the Kremlin when he was murdered. That is the reality of Moscow today. You're not immune from that.
In this particular room, we have meeting with him and with the volunteers. We were preparing the big rally. And after this meeting with the volunteers, we went in the street and I was arrested for the 15 days and he was killed a week later. So I understand what's going on in Russia and I understand a lot of risks and I understand danger. But this is my country. I'm going to fight for my country.
Navalny's defiance ultimately cost him his life. But to the end, he remained unbowed. I asked him in Moscow if he ever questioned whether his activism against corruption was worth it.
I really hope that it will be never such a moment when I decide this, because it means that everything is useless, what I've done before. All this sacrifice made from my family, my brother, made by Boris Nemtsov, who was killed, he was shot in the back, close to the Kremlin. A lot of other people, we have political prisoners, hundreds of them all over the Russia. And if I will stop, it means all these sacrifices are useless. And they are not. And I do believe in what I'm doing. And I do believe that my alternative is better for Russia. And I'm absolutely agree. And I'm absolutely sure that we will succeed. And I believe in victory. And yes,
and when
we have a tough time right now. Yes, but trends, political trends, they are changing. People became poor. People asking questions. And I have the support from family and from people. And I'm not going to let them down.
In Alexei Navalny, Russia lost a fearless opponent of corrupt authoritarian power. On another continent, Tito Mboweni was another committed anti-corruption campaigner. He served as the first Labour minister in Nelson Mandela's post-apartheid South Africa. He later became the first black central governor of the country and subsequently finance minister. He had his critics, but his journey from freedom fighter to senior politician served as an enduring example to many South Africans.
We are determined to make sure that the rule of law in the Republic of South Africa holds the ground. So anybody who faces fraud and corruption charges must face the law. They must go to court, explain their case, respond to the prosecution's case, and then the judge must determine whether they're guilty or not. South Africa is a law-governed society, and anybody who is accused of any wrongdoing must appear before the court, whether it's the Minister of Finance or is the President of the Republic, it doesn't matter, or whether you're a retired military general or whatever the case might be. If you're accused and the prosecutorial authorities have a case against you, you must go to court and answer, irrespective of who you are. One thing that's very unique about me, if I might just say something about myself, I call a spade and not a big spoon. And if you call a spade, you are going to get into trouble from time to time.
Politics is a tough business. So too is pursuing excellence in the creative arts. Reserves of resilience and determination are needed to make the most of innate talent. Take the physically ultra-demanding world of ballet. Back in 2017, Michaela de Prince came into the Hard Talk studio. Hers was a remarkable life story. From horrific childhood suffering in Sierra Leone to success and acclaim in the world of dance. She died this year, aged just 29. When I met her, I asked her to reflect on the lasting impact of her childhood experience of war.
For me, it's mostly just little tiny images, and the only parts I really remember now, I don't remember the faces of my biological mom and father. I can see their figures, but I don't even remember what they look like. And if I'm thinking or dreaming or having a nightmare, it's mostly about running from the rebels or the things people were yelling at me about, or it's mostly those things and just the emotions I was feeling. And that's what I wake up yelling and screaming about and having to recover from and going to be able to recover from that and still being able to go to work that day.
It's interesting you say you feel less connected than you used to. And of course, as you grow up, the memories become more distant. But it's interesting to me that you've chosen to write about it for a young audience around the world. I mean, this book, Ballerina Dreams, has recently come out in Europe, and it's billed as a true story. And you do go into some of the detail of what it was like to be a girl at a time of war. So you don't want to completely forget about it.
No, I don't want to completely forget about it. It's made me who I am today, and it doesn't have as many details as Hope in the Valley Shoe, but I think it's very important for people to not forget about the struggles that they've been through, because it creates who you are. And if I didn't go through those things, I wouldn't be as strong as I am today, because I go through horrible things every single day in my dance career. And people say things to me that maybe I would cry about, but it doesn't necessarily faze me anymore because of the things I've been said to before. But, you know, that's what makes it so beautiful, though, is that you can use the things that you've been through to connect with the audience, and that is what art is, and that's what makes it so passionate. And I mean, sometimes it's hard, but at the same time, you have to have the right support system, the right people who can help you bring you back into reality.
Do you think, in a sense, finding your path through dance sort of saved you?
Oh, it's definitely what saved me. Definitely. I don't think I would be the person I am today. I don't think I would be. I don't think I would be happy at all. If I hadn't danced, I would be still that angry little girl that I was.
A hugely influential figure in UK politics died this year at the age of 86. John Prescott was an old-style political heavyweight who played a vital role in the modernisation of the UK Labour Party, ultimately paving the way for Tony Blair's landslide victory in 1997. Now, politics can be a blood sport, and Prescott certainly had the scars to prove that. But as Deputy Prime Minister for 10 years during the three-term premiership of Tony Blair, his position in Labour history is indisputable.
Seems to be a debate in the party. There are some people who are wheeling out the rhetoric of class war, looking at tax rates in particular, and wanting to see...
What do you think his budget's about if it isn't about class?
Is it all about class?
Do you know 50p reducing it, actually reducing the benefits of people and the most poorest in society, actually saying your wages have got to stoop, letting the bankers go free, reducing 50p if that's going to be, sounds class to me, doesn't it to you?
I'm interested that after...
Wealthy are better off,
after,
the poorer are worse off.
After
isn't
New Labour, after Tony Blair, after everything you've been through in politics, are you saying to me that Britain is as class-based, class-driven today as it was when you entered politics?
Yes. Don't you understand that? Let me just give you an example if you want. If you look at our education system, for where most of it comes from, leave alone the social backgrounds, but the education system, 7% of our children go into private schools. They get the top amount of universities at the top universities. They get all the top jobs in the banks and the insurance, etc., from that very small base of 7%. Why do you think that comes about? Is it those 7% are just the better educated, or is it the old school tie and the fact that you can pay for your education?
What did 13 years of Labour, Blair, then Brown, actually achieve then? Because the whole point was to try and change British society.
How about 2 million more jobs? Will you settle for that? 2 million more jobs? Will you settle for more money into hospitals, education, etc.? That's what I came into politics for. Now what's happening is the obvious. They're reducing the opposite, all the money in the public service. And we're back to 3 million unemployed.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Stephen Sacker, looking at some of the past Hard Talk guests who died in 2024. US politics also lost a significant and successful vote winner this year in the form of Bob Graham, a hugely popular former Florida governor and Democratic Party senator who never lost an election. My colleague Zainab Badawi went to Florida to meet him back in 2017 as the Democrats were recovering from the shock of losing the White House to Donald Trump.
I think one of the lessons, and there are a number of lessons from the 2016 election, was that Trump or people on his behalf had been listening to what the American people were saying. And what they were hearing was that many people felt government had forgotten about them, disrespected them, was not dealing with the issues that affected their lives. Trump was... and Senator Sanders on the Democratic side with the two candidates who did listen. I think one of the challenges to the Democratic Party is going to be to reconnect with what had been its most reliable source of support, working people who deal day to day with those economic problems that cause them to be so distressed. And I also believe that with our core constituency, we have lost touch. What the message that we were communicating was not what they were interested in listening to. We've got a challenge to come up with some creative solutions to the issue of the forgotten American and the political skill to put those ideas into place.
Just weeks ago, the hugely successful novelist Barbara Taylor Bradford died. Born into relative poverty in Yorkshire, Her talent for storytelling turned her into one of the richest women in Britain. Beginning with the acclaimed novel, A Woman of Substance, published in 1979, destined to become one of the best-selling novels of all time, she churned out a book almost every year. I spoke to her in 2009.
You have made yourself a vast fortune, and you've got grand homes and fine antiques and all of that.
One home.
All right, but it is rather a lovely one.
Yes.
In New York. I mean, do you have a tremendous satisfaction at what you've achieved? Do you sort of think, I have become a woman of substance?
No. I'm glad that I have success with the books. And, of course, it's nice to make money. Who would knock that? But I'm not like that. I'm worrying all the time. Is the next book going to work? Or, oh, when will I get down to starting the new one? I'm a bit of a worrier. But I suppose I'm a little bit proud, too, that I accomplished something with my life and wrote 25 popular novels that people love.
And do you care whether they will love them in the next generation and the one after that, i.e., do you care that they will last?
I'd like them to, but I won't be here, will I? So I won't know. I can't think that far ahead.
Do you think they will?
I don't know. Maybe some. Who knows?
Barbara Taylor Bradford's success was built on the portrayal of strong women, overcoming life's slings and arrows. In short, women a bit like her. I asked her whether she considered herself a committed feminist.
I think I did, but I didn't see myself as a joiner of organisations because I'm rather a loner. You've got to be a loner to be a writer and sit in solitary confinement all day. But I did see myself looking around at my friends who wanted to be movie directors or work in a big business and be the managing director. Women were getting restless in the 70s, and I think Margaret Thatcher just came in and clinched it, and we all thought we could do it.
Has your view of how hard women have to struggle and perhaps some of the institutions and attitudes in society that hold women back and are perhaps unfair to women in many cases, has it changed over the last 30 years, do you think?
I think it has, and for the better. I think women are not as far as they could have gone. They haven't gone as far as they could have gone. But that's not because of the women. I think there are still men out there who honestly don't want women to succeed. There are a lot of men that do. My husband is always rooting for women to succeed in the world of business or film or publishing because he loves women and he sees their talent. But there are people. It's a man's world still.
The legendary American actor James Earl Jones died this year at the age of 93. In a career spanning 7 decades, he was the recipient of an honorary Oscar for his lifetime achievements. When I spoke to him in 2011, he was still starring in plays on both sides of the Atlantic. He was perhaps best known across the world for his unique voice, rich and deep, which became the voice of Darth Vader in the Star Wars movies. Yet he had a very strong view about the shortcomings of Hollywood.
I wonder when the occupiers are going to start occupying movie studios. Talk about distorted ratio of salaries. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
Yeah. I wouldn't turn it down, mind you, because it's money. Someone would put millions of dollars in my pocket, I'm not going to say no, no, no. But it is ridiculous. What job of work is worth more than $1 million? What job of work in the world is a king's job worth more than $1 million? No.
I'm interested in this train of thought, which is that Hollywood and everything it can offer somebody like you or any talented actor is sort of sucking up so much of the interest and the talent.
It's very complex because it's not just the actor, it's the actor's agent. There's a whole competition among actors' agents. It's about their competition to get bigger salaries. And once you get bigger salaries, you got it even bigger. And And what bothers me is the actors below the lead actor, who has to suffer a much less salary because the lead is getting multi-million dollars. Mm.
James Earl Jones was raised in poverty in segregation-era America. He moved to New York and took up acting when young black men were supposed to know their place and stick to it. He lived through times of enormous social change, from the fight for civil rights to the election of a black president. I asked him how close the United States had come to genuine racial equality.
I came out of the army. I'd heard Malcolm X talk. I thought, well, maybe there will be a race war. But it was all folly. Malcolm X never visited the South. I had. Martin Luther King was a man of the South. And I didn't even really trust him.
You didn't trust King?
No.
Why?
He was a preacher. I didn't trust preachers.
But as a young black man, if you didn't, you certainly didn't, it sounds like, sympathize with Malcolm X, you didn't entirely trust Martin Luther King, and yet surely the message from King in particular resonated with you, that it was time for black people to take their just deserts from this society.
It was the religious aspect of King. Once I understood his footsteps of Mahatma Gandhi, I said, yeah, he's the rightly kind of leader. But the other stuff that followed him, the ones who rejected him saying we want more black power, that was folly, not well-designed activism. And that's, I decided, I don't want any part of that. I learned early there's a difference between consciousness. Racial consciousness is good. You should understand your people, understand your culture. But to be conceited about it, that's where the danger lies. Mm. And so many young people, with the anger pushing this gorge up, it becomes conceit and misplaced anger.
To end, let's reflect on one more loss for American culture this year, the death of the novelist Paul Auster, widely regarded as one of the most influential American novelists of his generation. Auster had a distinctive postmodern approach to storytelling that was regarded as being well ahead of its time. His breakthrough fiction, The New York Trilogy, won worldwide acclaim in the 1980s.
Writing, or art in general, doesn't do anything tangible in the world. It doesn't fix a toilet the way a plumber can fix a toilet. It doesn't fix a broken arm the way a doctor can fix a broken arm. It is, in a sense, useless. But this uselessness, I think, is the very definition of what makes human life so exciting to live, is because we do have this ability to think and to reflect on what we're thinking and to think about the world and to make art out of that.
And to value beauty.
But it doesn't have any concrete purpose in life in the way that all these practical occupations do. A book is read by one person at a time. And the book, in spite of everything, is the only place, I think, in the human world where two strangers can meet on terms of absolute intimacy. And that space that is created in the book is something very beautiful and precious. And whether 10 people read the book, or 10,000 people read the book, or 10 million people read the book, it doesn't matter. The person reading it is alone with the writer. And the two of you, the writer and the reader, are creating the book together. And every reader reads a different book. And this is what's so beautiful about it. We all bring our own lives, our own sufferings, our own joys, our past, to whatever it is we encounter in the world. And nothing, never more so than when we're encountering art, and particularly literature, which requires time. I can look at the paintings on the wall in a glance and see what's there. But if I pick up this 750-page book, no, I can't take it all in at once. I have to give it time. And that time is the beautiful thing about it.
In your own life, imagine you're sort of living a life where you could look back at moments, the sliding doors moments when things might have been different. Are there now things you wish you had done or decisions you'd taken in a different way which would have taken you down different pathways, different avenues?
Is there a human being of our age who doesn't feel some regret about some things we've done? in the past. I can't imagine a human being who wouldn't have some second thoughts about a decision he or she made years before.
Regrets?
Well, I don't even want to talk about it.
Why?
They're too personal. I mean to say, I suppose, you know, people that I attach myself to without really understanding the nature of that other person fully enough. And let's leave it at that.
If you'd like to listen to in-depth, hard-hitting interviews with newsmakers from around the world, search for Hard Talk wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler, host of the Global Story podcast from the BBC. Each weekday, we break down one big news story with fresh perspectives from journalists around the world. From artificial intelligence to divisive politics tearing our societies apart. From the movements of money and markets to the human stories that touch our lives. We bring you in-depth insights from across the BBC and beyond. Listen to the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.